Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and never miss an episode. Today, we're talking with J.P. Green. He's the distinguished professor and head of the Department of Education Reform at the University of Arkansas. He also runs the incredibly creatively named blog, which is called J.P. Green's Blog, which is actually pretty great if you're interested not simply in education issues, but a wide range of topics that most sentient beings in North America would be interested in. As I look at it now, it's got a picture of Guns N' Roses' Appetite for Destruction album cover at the top of it. So it's got a lot going on. Jay is a leading scholar in the field of school choice analysis studies, and we're going to talk with him today about the efficacy of charters and vouchers and other types of school reform, what he thinks of Betsy DeVos, Donald Trump's controversial pick for Secretary of Education, and the state of education reform in general, especially where he sees it going down blind alleys. So J.P. Green of University of Arkansas, by way of Chicago and Florida, thank you so much for talking to Reason.
Thank you. I'm excited to be on your podcast.
All right. Well, that's because you obviously are leading a life of quiet desperation, it sounds like. But let's talk about Betsy DeVos, who is Trump's pick for Secretary of Education. Had a kind of grueling set of confirmation hearings. Most likely will be, she'll sail through. What's your general sense of her? Is she a good pick, bad pick? Why or why not?
So I think the first thing to establish is how it's not that important. So I do want to answer the question about what I think about Betsy DeVos, but it's first important to establish that it actually doesn't matter that much who the Secretary of Education is. Federal government only pays for 10% of education funding.
But they do.
Almost all of that is by formula.
But don't they? I mean,
very little discretion.
But
over
they
it.
Wait. But then they only pay for overall. It's mostly states and localities that pay for K-12 education, as well as
right.
a big chunk of college. But don't they attach a lot of regulations to that money, and so that any school that receives any kind of federal spending is effectively under the federal thumb?
That's true, but education is one of the last places where federalism still does live.
Mm-hmm.
Even though there are conditions attached to that 10% funding from the feds, the federal government has very limited ability to monitor or enforce any of that,
mm-hmm.
and for the most part, schools are controlled by states and localities.
So it doesn't matter who's in. Well, it doesn't matter that much, right?
And yeah, it matters on the margin.
Okay,
but it's not as if we're talking about who the national superintendent of education is going to be. It's the person who sits in that chair does not run the nation's schools in any sense.
Mm-hmm. So then, what why are people so upset at
well,
Betsy DeVos?
I think a lot of people lack a fundamental understanding of how our political system operates, and
mm-hmm.
so they don't really understand federalism, and they don't understand that education is one of the places where federalism still lives, although it might be on life support.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's some of it. People are fascinated with whatever happens in D.C., and they think that that is everything that matters. And one of the great things about education is that it's spread across the country and it's controlled across the country, and
mm-hmm.
places that coastal elites would rather not care about actually are still running things for the most part.
So is that and in your mind, that's generally speaking, it's a good thing, even if some of the school districts in the country are doing things that you just think are idiotic?
Right. I mean, that's one of the things that comes with freedom, is that,
mm-hmm.
Sometimes people choose things that are silly, but at least it's their own choices that they're living under.
Can I ask, in the great scheme of things, or at least, in the 50 states, and, let's be coastal elites and just say we're only talking about the 48 contiguous states, but, what state is best at education from your point of view, and how would you define that, and what is the absolute worst that is doing something silly?
Yeah, I don't know that I know the right answer to
mm-hmm.
that. Each state is doing some mix of good and silly things. I think some states are sillier.
Well, what counts
but
as silly in
areas
in your
of education reform, Indiana has a number of creative programs. Arizona, I think, actually is quite exciting in a number of ways. And it might be worth talking about Arizona in particular, because it gets us back to the topic of charter schools and Betsy DeVos.
Okay, so let's first answer the question about Betsy DeVos, because she's, you know, she was picked because she is a proponent, a public proponent of school choice in charter schools, as well as other instruments of choice. Is that a good type of person to have in charge of the federal Department of Education?
Right. Now, there are limits to what a secretary can do in general, but even specifically on what a secretary could do with respect to school choice. But to the extent that a secretary could rhetorically promote school choice and also fail to use the federal government to persecute school choice, Betsy DeVos is the strongest supporter of school choice that has ever been nominated for Secretary of Education, and probably the strongest supporter school choice advocates are ever likely to get in that office.
Can I ask that anybody, did they come sniffing around asking for J.P. Green? Did they say, well, you know, we know you've got this blog, and we want you to be the Secretary of Education?
No one asked me to be Secretary of Education, nor would I be an appropriate Secretary of Education. But she is a strong supporter of the idea of school choice. Her ideas are not generally extreme in the area of school choice. She favors reasonably moderate regulatory schemes for school choice, and that puts her kind of in the mainstream of ed reformers, but puts her out of sync with the teacher unions and the Democratic Party by a long shot. And so that's part of why they're so upset about her. They're also upset because she is not a technical master of the subject. She is not an experienced researcher or policy advocate. She has been a donor and supporter. And so it shouldn't be surprising that when questioned by hostile members of Congress that, you know, there are a lot of things that she can't answer particularly well because that's not her forte. But it's not clear whether that matters. Having someone who's technically fluent in education policy doesn't necessarily give you good policy. It doesn't even necessarily give you good technical answers. It just gives you someone who knows how to talk like they have technical answers.
Can I ask, though, and I ask this respectfully of a guy who's running an educational program and who is in charge of a program that grants a PhD in education reform, right, at Arkansas?
Yeah, our degree is in education policy. Yeah.
Okay, education policy. Yeah. So it's like, doesn't it make sense that the person would have a passing familiarity with the subject area or the policy area that they are going to be running?
Right. Well, she certainly has a passing familiarity. Yeah. I think there was some brouhaha over whether she had command over the difference between growth scores and proficiency levels.
Right.
And perhaps she knows it by different nomenclature, or perhaps she's just was confused in the moment.
Yeah.
It doesn't really matter, in a sense, because what matters is the set of principles and values that a person holds, so that if they're pointed in the right direction, other people around them might have the technical expertise to help when needed. And so I'm not sure that's the most important qualification for high office is technical mastery. I'd rather have good values and principles than apparent technical competence.
Well, then let's talk about the state of school choice in general. And what to you, first off, is school choice growing? And then what are those general principles or directions that would best undergird the school choice movement as we talk about it?
Right. Well, school choice is actually doing remarkably well. It has gone essentially from nothing in 1990. We had no charter schools, and we had, other than century-old tiny voucher programs, we had virtually no private school choice either in 1990. And so here in less than three decades, we have gone from zero to almost 3 million kids participating in either charter or private school.
How many total K through 12 students? So there's 3 million.
So there are 50 million total.
Okay.
And 3 million are currently actively participating in charter or private school choice. So, you know, 0 to 6% in about a quarter century. Now,
there are some places like the district that covers New Orleans in Louisiana that is essentially 100% choice, right? Where people are more or less, kids are going to schools that they or their parents actively choose rather than just being assigned there residentially.
Exactly. I mean, if we concentrated on some urban centers, they're approaching or exceeding 50% in D.C., Chicago, Detroit. It's near zero when you get out into more rural areas.
Right.
And so the 3 million nationwide, makes it look like 6% nationwide. But if you look at where choice is more likely to be practical, it's a much higher percent than 6%.
So what happened starting in 1990 that really ignited the school choice movement to a point where it went from zero to 3 million kids in since the 90s?
Well, what you needed initially were policy entrepreneurs, people willing to take a risk on a new idea. To see how it would go and collect some evidence about how it was going. And so there were policy entrepreneurs in Wisconsin, in mm-hmm. Minnesota, where they started charters and private school choice programs. But the interesting thing about school choice is that once you start it, it begins to create its own constituency. That is, once people benefit from being able to control the education of their own children, they do not readily give it up, and they will fight if they're able to keep it and expand it. And so once policy entrepreneurs have started programs, the programs naturally grow. So in a way, school choice advocates don't have to do anything at this point, and school choice will continue to grow. It has achieved escape velocity, where the idea has legitimacy, it's getting relatively common, and especially when upper middle class families benefit from these programs, they will fight to keep them.
Right.
And to expand them. And that is already happening, regardless of who's in office or who's the Secretary of Ed.
So talk a little bit about, you mentioned when it gets to upper middle class people who, of course, practice a version of school choice, by moving into a particular town or a school district that has housing values of a certain level and, schools of a certain quality, et cetera. School choice had always started, and you mentioned, I think Milwaukee had either the first or one of the first voucher programs, and I know Reason wrote about this back in the early 90s, and it was kind of pushed partly by a state legislature, state legislator named Polly Williams, I believe, who was a former member of the Black Panther Party. And, I mean, she was doing this to help, inner city minorities in Milwaukee especially. Why did school choice start with, or why has it started with lower income people and now is migrating to, upper middle class people?
Well, things were desperately bad in education for lower income families, and so people were more willing to try something new and different.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's part of why school choice efforts began with a focus on disadvantaged students. But if it stays only with disadvantaged students, it's a plant that has been put in an iron pot and cannot grow and thrive. Because the difficulty that low-income families have politically is that they're not well situated to advocate to protect their programs or to expand them.
Which is one of the reasons why their schools often suck to begin with, right?
That's right, right. And so upper middle class families have lots of advantages educationally. In addition to having the resources to move to areas mm-hmm. with desired schools, they also have the resources to purchase private school if they want, or they also have the political resources to exercise greater control over the schools their kids are in.
Right.
But even with all of those advantages, our system of education still leaves upper middle class families not fully satisfied.
Right. So talk about mm-hmm. Arizona then. You had mentioned Arizona is doing, you know, a kind of wide open series of reforms that move in the direction of choice. What's good about that? You know, what are they doing in particular? And why is the principle of choice, you know, worth pushing into K through 12 education?
Right. Well, school choice in Arizona was not narrowly focused on disadvantaged families, but actually reached kind of a full spectrum of families from poor to rich. And in doing so, wealthier families began to discover that while they were reasonably well satisfied with their traditional public options, that when they were given other options, they liked them even better.
Mm-hmm.
And there are now long waiting lists of upper middle class families trying to get into some very good charter schools in Arizona. And so that is a powerful political force for protecting and expanding charter school choice. In addition, Arizona has been a pioneer in the creation of ESAs, or education savings accounts, which is a form of private school choice. The government gives money to families, and then they can use that pot of money to purchase education services or to save some of that money to roll over for the future.
So it's kind of like – and that gets around any issues about church and state, because it's kind of like a Pell Grant where it goes to the individual who then spends it.
Right. It goes into an account that the individual controls, so that gets around church-state issues. In addition, it helps prevent price controls.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the problems with traditional vouchers is that the government is essentially fixing the price for a private school education, and every school that charges less than that amount immediately raises the tuition to it, and any school that charges more has difficulty. So it's better to have the price mechanism preserved, and ESAs allow that to happen.
How closely is it tracked what you spend that on? I mean, do you have to take ESA money and spend it at an accredited school or institution, or can you say, hey, you know what, my kid is really into sailing or something, or you know, aviation, and I'm going to go, you know, figure out, you know, they're going to learn how to fly a plane or something.
There are rules, but the rules are fairly broad, mm-hmm. and so it can purchase a fairly broad set of educational services, including things like horse therapy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
by
there,
the way,
so there
is,
are lots-
is that therapy? Is that for the kid or for the horse?
Perhaps both.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing about it is that because the family is making choices about mm-hmm. each individual service that they're purchasing with that money and have the option to roll the money over for the future, if the money is not effectively being used, they would save it rather
right.
than waste it. And so really you're empowering families to make decisions about what's helping their kid
and
to customize for their kid.
Does everybody get the same amount, or do you apply for that in instead of going to a charter school or a regular public school? And is excuse me if I'm throwing too many questions at you, but hasn't Nevada done something similar as well?
Right. Nevada is the first state to pass a statewide universal ESA program.
Mm-hmm.
It survived a church-state constitutional challenge, but it did not survive a technical court challenge having to do with its funding source. Its funding
mm-hmm.
source was from a pool that it could not take money from. And so the mechanism is on the books and is constitutional, but the funding is now not there. And
okay.
so they're searching for a funding fix of being able to take the money from a different pool.
Hey,
they'll be able to achieve that or not, I don't know. But
yeah. I was going to say that legalized prostitution with a heavy tax or pot, here we come in the silver state. But
to
go back though to the ESA then in Arizona. So how does that work then in terms of how much money do people
get? Well, I mean, each ESA program will have its own sets of rules, and so the Nevada one is different from the Arizona one, which is different
mm-hmm.
from one in Georgia. But the general principle of it is that that you would put more money in for kids who were more expensive to educate.
Mm-hmm.
And so students with disabilities, for example, the Arizona ESA is for students with special needs, and they get, I believe, 90% of what they would receive in their traditional public school. So the state is saving money.
Yeah.
Which is a big attraction to state legislators. And the family is getting a variable amount based on the amount that would be provided for their kid, given their kid's particular needs.
So, you know, you mentioned that these programs, and I guess this is part of the lure of choice and also the anxiety caused by it, is that people can personalize and customize their education and or their kids' education. And it's, you know, it's weird that over the past 30 years, say, or, you know, since 1990, let's say, you know, our lives in every area outside of government, for the most part, and even in some parts of government, have become more personalized and more customized. And we recognize that every time we go to Starbucks or Chipotle, you know, we love that, the fact that we can change what we want based on what we want.
Right.
And why is it, I mean, it causes absolute conniptions in the educational space.
Sure.
You know, well, it's the last redoubt of like industrial era thinking.
Once you're able to achieve it, people like it and fight for it. And so, one of the political mistakes that the ed reform movement made early on was believing that the opportunities that were possible, like Milwaukee, were then the ideal program. So that in the future, you should only, you know, target highly disadvantaged areas. And that was thought of as the ideal program within the ed reform movement. But what that did is it hurt the political prospects of expanding school choice by focusing choice on constituents who were not politically positioned to fight for it. And what's happening now, not by design of the ed reform movement, but by accident, is that in Arizona, there was essentially benign neglect by the ed reform movement. People weren't even paying attention to Arizona. None of the big national foundations were heavily involved there in expanding the charter sector. And mostly the charter sector was created and expanded because they had horrible overcrowding problems in their traditional public schools. So not by any particular design, we got this wild west of school choice in Arizona. And the beauty of it is that it's now a political juggernaut. You cannot touch it in Arizona. And so what we need is for national ed reform to kind of get behind this politically more effective approach to expanding school choice. That is, by offering programs to the full spectrum of the country, rich and poor alike.
Right. Well, before we go to how different movements or different influences in ed reform are doing that, talk a little bit about the benefits of school choice, you know, in kind of hard terms, as much as we can come up with numbers or statistics and data that show this. Last summer, for instance, John Oliver in his HBO Weekly show did a broadside attack shortly before the new school year started in September. I think this was in late August, where he ranted about charter schools and about how, you know, they're run by incompetent people or insane people. A lot of them close. A lot of them are terrible. They don't necessarily, on average, do better than public schools. And it was clear that there's a backlash brewing to school choice. There are a lot of vested interests in the, you know, in traditional public education or publicly funded education. Do charter schools work? And how do they work for students? And how do things like voucher programs or other choice programs, how do they actually benefit students and perhaps taxpayers and parents as well?
Right. So first, I think it's important to note that as researchers or policymakers, it's difficult to talk about whether a program in education works for families, since after all, that's imposing our preferences of what's good in education on families that may have legitimate different sets of preferences. And so,
J.P. Green, do you believe in evolution? You're in Arkansas now.
Right.
I
believe in education, but I understand that other people don't. And that one of the things that happens with freedom is that you let people hold beliefs that you disagree with.
Now you're just talking crazy. You're right. From Chicago? What's going on? Yeah.
There's something horribly oppressive about education elites determined to impose their set of preferences on everybody else. And you know, essentially, education is child-rearing. It's just raising our children to be the kinds of adults we hope they could be. And different people have different ideas about what they want for their children. So imposing any single goal on other people's children is fraught with danger. So we have limited tools to look at whether people are achieving their own goals. The first tool is basically, are people choosing and satisfied with their choices? And the evidence is overwhelming there that people, when given options, use them, and they're very satisfied when they get to choose the school that they prefer.
Can we put any details on that? Because I can remember in the past looking at if you look at data that that polls parents of school age children, and it'll say, you know, are you very satisfied or mostly satisfied or not satisfied at all with your kids' education? And if I'm remembering correctly, people who send their kids to religious schools are the most satisfied, and it's like 98%. Then private schools that are not religious are in the high 90s. Charter and voucher programs of public schools tend to be in the 90s. But the traditional public school, which is the lowest of the bunch, is still in somewhere in the 70s or 80s, right?
Yeah, although, I mean, it's difficult to gauge how satisfied people are because people give you answers with respect to the options they have. Mm-hmm. So when people have no options and you ask them if they're okay with what they have, they will give you rationalizations about their lives. They'll say it's not so bad.
Right.
So you don't only really know how much people like something when they have an alternative that they could go to instead. Then you really know.
So this is one of the powerful arguments in favor of, charter schools have waiting lists, whereas very few, failing, if they're failing, the waiting list goes away, whereas in failing traditional schools.
And in fact, one of the fascinating things in Arizona is how effective school closure is by lack of parental demand. So there is accountability, real accountability in Arizona, because on average, charter schools that close in Arizona close within 4 years with an average of 62 students. So basically, they're closing for lack of enrollment because people don't like them. And so we don't need regulators to close down bad schools. We just need parents to have alternatives, and they'll close them down for us. That John Oliver was denouncing, that's a good thing. That's good. That means that bad schools that are not serving the interests of families are not continuing to operate.
And do you think, and I realize you've given yourself a perfect escape hatch on this, one which I ideologically absolutely agree with in your pay into freedom and different value systems, but are uneducated or less educated poor parents, can they be relied upon to make good decisions to turn their children into good upper middle class kids, like all of the elite reformers or traditionalists want?
Sure. So let me give two answers to that. One is we let people vote. If we let people choose the leader of the United States and all their elected representatives, how do we not let them make decisions about their own children? If we think low income people are qualified to vote, then they should be qualified to make decisions about their own families. And if we don't think they're qualified to make decisions about their families, maybe we should reconsider this whole universal voting thing. Mm-hmm. But my second more serious answer is that we could look at outcomes that basically all of us might agree are kind of good long-term outcomes. And so we could look at high school graduation, college attendance, and lifetime earnings. And there's a fantastic study in Florida that looks at families that choose charter schools for their children relative to families that don't, who are essentially identical to them. And they tracked them actually for a very long time. And they found that if kids had access to charter schools in Florida, they graduated high school at a significantly higher rate. They went to college at a higher rate. They graduated college at a higher rate, and they have higher earnings into their young adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, you know, so if we think that those are good long-term outcomes,
right.
And I think most of us would agree, the evidence is pretty strong on positive long-term outcomes.
Talk, you know, in your
and that's true for vouchers, too. We also
right.
have long-term outcomes on high school graduation rates and college attendance from private school choice programs as well.
Yeah, talk about in your work you and at your blog, J.P. Crean's blog, look it up, people. You talk a lot about randomized control trials or RCTs.
Right.
For those of us who weren't schooled in social science, why is that so important and why is it often overlooked in discussions of school choice efficacy?
Right. So. We know that a student's background has a very strong influence on their future success. And so one of the biggest problems we have in studying things in education is making apple-to-apple comparisons, comparing people whose backgrounds really are the same. So what some people do is they just observe some characteristics of people and control for them statistically. So their race, their free lunch status, their age, things like that. And unfortunately, that does not fully capture the background differences between people. And so the ideal way to make an apple-to-apple comparison is to assign people by lottery to different conditions. So some people get access to a program by chance. Some people don't. On average, they'd be identical in their backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
And then we could be confident that any differences we observe later on are caused by that having access to that program and not by unobserved and uncontrolled pre-existing
mm-hmm.
differences. And that's why it's so important. But there's another big problem that we have in education research is that not only do we fail to focus on more rigorous randomized control trials, but we also focus way too much on state test score results.
Hmm.
So as it turns out, state test score results are not very good predictors of long-term success. So the things we really care about are things like graduating high school, going to college,
mm-hmm.
having higher earnings, those things probably really matter. And we think the test scores are kind of a near-term proxy for those long-term outcomes. But that's false. As it turns out, there's a growing body of research that shows that you can boost scores on the state test and not improve any long-term outcome. And
so you can teach to the test and have success,
right.
and it'll show that your school district has a high rate of at grade level proficiency or it'd be even better than that. But that is really neither here nor there.
State tests are easily gameable,
mm-hmm.
And they're also very narrow measures of what it is that education is trying to accomplish.
Hmm.
And so it's missing all of these other kinds of skills and values that are an important part of developing our children into the kinds of adults we want them to be. It focuses instead on some very, very narrow sets of skills that even if they're properly measured, which often they're not, that's not the entirety of an education. And so by focusing on state tests, we're also narrowing the whole purpose of education and shortchanging all of those other skills and values that are important for long-term success.
Let's talk about that and your interest in that in the context of education reform, because you know certainly at the higher education, you know in college and grad school and whatnot, you see a shift in rhetoric both on the right and the left that college really is a vote-tech program. It's a high-grade vocational system, and you know nobody should go to college unless they can get a job. You know, learn a job skill. What is wrong with that, and how is that working backwards through the K-12 system? Because in a lot of ways, wasn't that the point, one major point of the public school system as it really ratcheted up in the 20th century was to take a lot of immigrants or a lot of people with very different backgrounds and give them basic skills. I can remember my father who grew up in the 20s and 30s talking to myself and my siblings about how he learned how to read help wanted ads. At school, part of school was learning how to get a job and show up and shine your shoes and tie your tie and all that.
There's nothing wrong with all those things. The problem is the one-size-fits-none nature of our education system. So there's some appropriate mix of work-related skills and general liberal arts skills that we liberal arts knowledge that we might want people to acquire. And different families are going to have different preferences about the mix that they would want, not just in general for their children, but even each kid, right? For each child you have, you might think that one child is better suited to more of a liberal arts program and another child more to a vocational program. And our school system is not designed to allow you to cater to each of your child's needs, let alone your particular family's needs. And that's part of the appeal of school choice to upper middle class families, is that even they are kind of in big industrial suburban high schools where they get kind of a one size fits none that may not suit them very well.
So where does that, you know, and I love you, I'm writing down, you know, the plant in the iron pot, that's a great metaphor, and the one size fits none, which of course is a flip of the one size fits all type of nostrum you hear against government. Where does that industrial, or it's not where does that industrial sensibility about school come from, where we're all kind of like we're factory inputs and we're going to be made identical by coming out? This is for all of us who grew up listening to Pink Floyd's The Wall. You know, we get that. We know where it comes from. Why is it persisting into the 21st century, you know, an era of ridiculous individualization and personalization, of culture, of gender, of sexual orientation, of fashion? What's keeping it in check?
Well, I mean, part of it is there are vested interest groups that, like teacher unions, like superintendent associations, and so on, that benefit from existing arrangements and wish to preserve them. But more generally, there is a fear of freedom. Freedom is frightening to people who are able to make choices for themselves, but don't like the choices that other people might make, and wish to put constraints on other people's choices or control other people. And this is a very common inclination. And so there's constantly a struggle between those who favor liberty as an abstract principle and those who favor it only for themselves. Right. I want liberty for me, but for you, I want to make sure that you choose the right thing, what I think is the right thing.
You know, make a pitch for the liberal arts, because you kind of snuck that in. And I'm with the liberal arts all the way. And I say this with some hesitation, that the liberal arts made me the person and the terrible citizen and human being that I might be. But what is the benefit of a liberal arts approach or to education, you know, K through 12, not just at the college level?
Right. Now, again, it may not be the best or most desirable thing for all families, but it certainly is for many families. And the reason is that liberal arts really has to do with the kind of general knowledge that's associated with understanding the human condition, understanding what it is to be a human being, and where you are situated in your society, and where your society is situated relative to others across time and space. And that kind of understanding of what it is to be a human being helps shape our values and our preferences in very important ways. And so, for example, I've been doing a lot of research lately on what students learn from going to art museums or to see live theater. Okay, so we've actually been randomly assigning school groups to go on field trips or not to art museums or to see live theater. And what we found is that when kids go to these kinds of culturally enriching activities, they learn content knowledge, but even more importantly, they actually score higher on measures of tolerance. That is, they become more liberty-focused. The reason for it, I think, is that they are exposed to a broader world with a diverse set of views by getting out of their narrow prison-like school, and they become more liberty-loving. A little bit. I mean, these are not huge effects. These are small things. But
I am thinking back to a barely repressed memory of when I grew up in New Jersey, and I actually went to Catholic school. It was not my choice. It was my parents' exercising of school choice. But everybody in New Jersey, a couple times a year, we would end up being shipped to the Garden State Art Center, as it was called then, and we would see high culture ballets mm-hmm. and operas, and it destroyed an entire generation of people. I might have liked classical music if I had not seen it under those circumstances.
I see. Well, you know, it's possible that that not everyone learns to like it.
Yeah.
That's not the point. The point is that you learn that it exists.
Right.
And so one of the difficulties that especially disadvantaged kids have is that their worlds are incredibly narrow. Mm-hmm. They're tiny. And they're frightened, frankly, of things outside of their tiny world. And part of what an education can do is to broaden your horizons, like the benefits of travel. And in fact, we've, as part of this experiment, even randomly assigned kids to watch a movie instead of see a play.
Yeah.
So they could watch a movie of Twelfth Night by chance, or see a play of Twelfth Night, or be in a control back in their school. And a movie does not produce the same things that going in person to see a play
wow.
does.
That's really fascinating and kind of heartening.
A little bit. I mean, again, you know, I don't want to overstate
right.
how big these effects are.
I'm
just saying that the idea of culturally enriching field trips is disappearing from schools because they're narrowly focused on maximizing math and reading test scores.
Okay. And I also I assume these things, and I hear this from my own kids, one who graduated from college recently, another who's in high school, but you hear the high school doesn't have the resources for that as
they
well.
Do.
Yeah.
They do.
Now, of course, that you never hear. You know, it's rare when the high school doesn't have the resources to field an incredibly bad football team. You don't hear that story as much as we can't go to a play or a concert.
I can tell you that it's a challenge even when I offer these field trips for free.
Yeah,
I'll even pay for the buses for schools to go, and they still refuse.
So, and you were saying that there's a large chunk of good-hearted people in ed reform who are okay with that because they think it's more important to have tests, proficiency tests, and to have students do well on that.
Right. They have a highly reductionist view of what education is. They think their job, and it's very patronizing, actually, they think their job is to help disadvantaged kids increase their math and reading test scores so that they can score higher on the SATs and get into a better college. And basically, they're kind of imposing their own life's path onto other kids and imagining that they'll then come out the same as them.
Now,
realizing that their success actually is not really directly a function of their math and reading alone, but also mm-hmm. a function of all the other things about them that they learned in school
and
from their families.
And when we're talking about the liberal arts, we're talking about a wide range of basically of non-vocational skills. So we're talking about math and science, but literature, history, geography, social studies. And your argument is that it allows us to develop critical thinking, but also to situate ourselves and have the potential to become full participants in our society, essentially.
Right. Be even kind of culturally literate about what, mm-hmm. what kind of civilization we live in and what other civilizations are like. It's hard to be a competent citizen without more of that knowledge. And even within areas like reading, we're shortchanging more abstract things like poetry and literature.
Mm-hmm.
And within math, we shortchange abstract math for more applied math, all because it has an increasingly vocational tilt.
Yeah, there's a fascinating – whenever this kind of topic comes up, I always remember there's a passage in Frederick Douglass's autobiography. And, of course, you know, he was raised a slave. He was illegally taught to read by one of his master's wives. But he says at one point that he did not know what – he knew he wanted freedom and he knew the situation he was in. And slavery was terrible and wrong, but it was only when he read a pamphlet by a 19th-century Irish freedom fighter that it was articulated for him. And it's that kind of, you know, oftentimes random, you know, ability to connect across a different society, across a different ocean that – can really have a profound change in the way that we think, in the way that we act, in the way that we dream, really.
Yeah, I mean, so, and by the way, this is something that parents want for their children. They don't just want their children to be cogs in a future corporate machine, right? That is not the goal that parents always have for their children. They quite often have a dream of them being decent human beings who appreciate good things in life, who are kind to others. All of these things are learned in part through one's education. And if we reduce school to, you know, a handful of tests, we are going to harm all of these other goals that families legitimately have for their children.
Now, let me switch gears a little bit and try and hoist you on your own petard. And I know that phrase only from watching Batman reruns at some point. One of the villains was literally hoist on his own petard. And I think I'm using it right, but I have no guarantee.
See, that's cultural literacy right there.
Yeah, cultural illiteracy. I excel at. But you are doing a project where you're looking at the social media communications of major grant-making institutions that do education reforms, places like the Arnold Foundation, which I believe provides money to Reason Foundation, the nonprofit that publishes Reason.com and this website, the Broad Foundation, the Gates Foundation, the Walton Foundation, which is very powerful in school choice. And you're finding that they're making a lot of appeals to social justice rather than self-interest. Why does that concern you? Or, what is the import of that impression that you have?
Well, it goes back to my argument that the way in which choice becomes self-perpetuating is by upper middle class families benefiting from it and then advocating to preserve and expand it. And so this is a particular example of a more general rule about politics, which is politics is primarily driven by self-interest. Anyone who studies political science knows that self-interest is a dominant feature of the formation and continuation of political coalitions. And so it's very hard to advance a political cause by appealing to justice alone. Justice can help, but if your case is entirely for justice against people's self-interest, they will rationalize a different form of justice that's consistent with their self-interest and oppose you. And we just saw this, frankly, in Massachusetts, where there was a charter bill on the ballot, a charter initiative on the ballot, and voters defeated it 2-1. And this despite very strong evidence that Boston charter schools were producing very strong results. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so the evidence was pretty clear. The schools were narrowly focused on low-income, disadvantaged kids, and advocates made appeals to Massachusetts voters saying justice demands that you help low-income minority kids succeed. Mm-hmm. As it turns out, that appeal does not work. What works is offering programs to a broad array of voters that they can benefit from. They experience them, they like them, and then they support them. That's how it works in politics. And so there's a horrible political naivete that seems to have gripped ed reform leadership, where some of it, I think, is just kind of believing their own rhetoric too much. Some of it is a tilt towards youth and a lack of kind of more experienced political hands. Some of it is that it's kind of a world populated by elite college kids. And so the way you prevail in, you know, student government election at Oberlin is by appealing to social justice. But that's not how you win voters in Massachusetts, let alone in Tennessee or Louisiana. And if you want to win in Republican-dominated states, which now, by the way,
It's like all of them.
30-some states now have both legislatures controlled by Republicans. If you want to win there, then focusing on a diversity message for school choice is the wrong message. And so in doing a content analysis of the grant recipients from these large foundations, I found that they are 2-3-1 advocating for diversity and social justice over expanding school choice. Their messaging is all about social justice and diversity and very little about choice and liberty.
Well, you know, to talk about choice and liberty as a guiding principle, can you talk a little bit about your own education and kind of your ideological genealogy? You grew up in Chicago, and I assume you were educated there. I know you went to a couple of Boston area schools, Tufts, and then you somehow inexplicably managed to bump up. You've got a couple of degrees from Harvard.
I fooled them.
And by the way, I love, I don't know if you've watched the, I don't know if you get HBO in Arkansas, but the Young Pope, the show with Jude Law has a great slag on Harvard, which maybe I'm going to watch it until the series dies. But talk a little bit about your personal experience and kind of your growth or development of ideas over your intellectual career.
Yeah, well, I grew up in suburban Chicago, which is probably like suburban everywhere else. I went to New Trier High School, which is a famously good public high school.
Was it any good?
It actually really was.
Yeah.
It was fantastic. And when I arrived in college, I really felt much better prepared than most of my colleagues who went to other kinds of schools. So yeah, I think it served me particularly well. Now, it was a bit weird because, you know, to go to New Trier High School, you have to live in some very expensive real estate areas, right? So it essentially was a private school for those who could afford the real estate prices in that area. We would sit around the dinner table like a lot of upper middle class families and declare that we believed in public education. It wasn't just that we went to it. We believed in it. It was our religion. And, you know, my mom was a teacher and we really believed in it. And I believed in it. And I was a leftist in high school.
What does that mean? I mean, were you like burning down buildings or were you you were liberal? You identified as a centrist Democrat in high school or?
No, I was not a centrist Democrat. I thought I was an anarcho-socialist.
Okay.
right?
Yeah.
So I always had a suspicion of government. So that has stuck with me.
Right.
But I was on the left side of that.
Obviously you're working out your Oedipal aggression towards your parents you know, your mother was a public school teacher, so yes.
Right, although not entirely. I mean, my grandmother was a member of the Communist Party and gave me Chairman Mao's little red book for my bar mitzvah. That was my bar mitzvah gift from my grandmother.
That is the worst bar mitzvah gift that I have ever heard of. And I'm the next bar mitzvah I'm invited to. That's what I'm doing. I'm going to be like, hey, this is
it,
old school.
You know, so. Yeah. Well, it's about as incomprehensible as other texts. You know, I go off to Tufts. I think I'm a leftist. And then I kind of discover that I'm really not because the leftists around me at Tufts were so kind of oppressive and so controlling that I began to think maybe I was really on the right and not the left. And so I think that caused my drift towards more of a libertarian perspective was to see kind of how tyrannical people on the left could be, which I didn't really notice until I got off to college and was surrounded by people who thought of themselves as leftists. And then went off to grad school at Harvard. I studied under Paul Peterson and got involved in education policy research, was involved in the first evaluation of the Milwaukee School Voucher Program, and then have been involved since then. I've had faculty positions at the University of Houston, University of Texas, and here, and also had a long interlude at the Manhattan Institute in the middle.
Talk a bit about what it's like being, you know, one of these overeducated coastal elites. You're living in, you teach at University of Arkansas, which is in Fayetteville, Arkansas. That's the upper northwest corner of the oddly shaped state we know as Arkansas.
That's right.
What is it, you know, has that been a broadening experience for you? I say this as somebody who is very familiar with academic life, and a lot of people would say, no, I'm not, you know, if I'm not within 90 minutes drive of a beach, I'm not teaching there. What has been your experience?
I love it here, although I'm afraid to say that out loud because then people might move here and ruin it. it's college towns are just fantastic places. They have way more, kind of intellectual and cultural life than they otherwise would have any right to have. You know, we have live music, and I think It feels a little bit like Austin probably in the 70s or 80s.
Right.
Is about where we are now. And having lived in Austin when I was at UT, I could see some of the similarities, but we're not nearly as cool now as Austin is. But that's kind of good because it kind of, again, keeps everything cheap, accessible, easy. And my neighbors are nice people. There's something oddly nice about people here, some real decency. My neighbor Hoot, who unfortunately has passed away now, but when we first moved in, my neighbor Hoot arrived in a trucker cap and overalls to greet us and asked us what our home church was, which is what people do here because they're friendly. We explained that we didn't go to church, that we were Jewish, and he thought about that for a second, and he said, well, we're all people of the book, and so that we were all right with him.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think it is broadening. It's a fantastic life in college towns throughout the Mid-South and probably elsewhere. But also, you know, another big advantage is because the cost of living is so low, you just get on an airplane and go other places if you want to go, you know, see other things. And so that works much better, I think, than being a pauper in a big city.
What, you know, you've taught at a lot of different places in different parts of the country. Do you care to make sweeping generalizations about the students that you're encountering? And I'm assuming at University of Arkansas, like most state universities, it's a flagship Research One school, but most of the students are probably from Arkansas or nearby. Do you find that they're becoming, you know, is this idea of choice in life, is it in influencing and infecting all aspects of their lives, including education or kind of self-determination? Or is that a discussion and an argument that some of us interested in policy are having that's independent of, you know, and I'm making air quotes here, but the real America?
Well, so first on quality of students, I should emphasize that I teach only graduate students here. Mm-hmm. I've occasionally taught undergraduates, but have had relatively limited experience with the undergraduates here. My graduate students are fantastic, but we bring them in from all over the country.
Yeah.
And we offer them generous fellowships so that we get some of the best people. The undergraduates here, we're actually almost half Texan. Believe it or not. So we have a lot of out-of-state kids here. I think that actually the world of higher ed is a useful warning to private school choice advocates in K-12, which is with government subsidies comes government regulation, potentially, and also comes irresponsibility because there's someone else paying. And so one of the dangers in higher ed is that there are such large subsidies from others that it promotes irresponsible choices. People are doing things in school that may not really be the best thing, but they can do it because someone else is at risk financially.
What do you mean by that? That they just kind of, you know, because students rarely, you know, at any level are rarely paying the full bill, that they just goof off and drink and drug, or they take stupid classes, or they don't extract the most value they can from 4 years before starting
work. Yeah, I think all those things. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you reduce, I mean, frankly, there are some people in higher ed who don't really want to be there and probably shouldn't be there. But we have this kind of ideology of college for all, because there's one right path that we're trying to impose on everyone. And so we're subsidizing people into going to higher ed when they might not really want to be there, and they behave like they don't really want to be here.
Yeah, and then that it's not only a waste of their time, it influences everybody around them.
Sure, sure. It makes the place a little less serious
right.
than it might otherwise be. Now, that being said, there are also fantastic students
sure.
who are, because it's affordable, are getting world-class educations and
yep.
advancing in the world. So there are happy stories that go with the dangers of large subsidy. But when designing K-12 school choice, we might want to think a little bit about the extensive school choice we have in higher ed and what good and bad things may come from that.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, and we'll end on this now, do you think that there will come a tipping point towards student empowerment or individual empowerment in K-12 education? Now, you talked earlier about how we've attained escape velocity in school choice. Is this though kind of a, and I'm mixing metaphors here or using the wrong terms, but is it kind of like, we've got to replace that rocket or refuel that rocket to achieve escape velocity every day of every year of every century? Or will, in the same way that, the United States starting in the 19th century and certainly in the early 20th century kind of built a consensus of what education should be available, it should be universal, it should cover these things, it should be paid for in this way. Are we moving into an era where we will be doing that, but we'll be focusing more on the money attaching to individual children who then have a wider array of choices to develop themselves?
So I think much of education is really unchanging. So there are some kind of Brave New World folks in ed reform who think technology and the high level of customization that comes with technology is going to revolutionize education, and so it will be something completely unrecognizable to us in the future, where students essentially are taking every lesson and course
from Isaac Newton, and all of the great teachers of the universe and all that,
Right, and now as it turns out, and I think this is even related to the research I've done on the effects of live theater relative to a movie, is that there is something important about in-person interactions for the development of young people into adults. People respond to human beings in front of them in a way they don't to electronic representations of people, which is why people could be such jerks on Twitter, is that the person's not right in front of you. So I think that this brave new world is unlikely to revolutionize. I think parts of it will be adapted into education and will help change what we do. But much of education is the same thing that human beings have been trying to do for millennia, which is just kind of raise their children to be conscientious, productive, and decent human beings who have a broad interest in the world. That's often an aspiration that families have. And the details of that change, but the broad outlines don't change very much. And the mechanisms for doing it are basically, older human beings somehow, interacting with younger human beings to help them become that. That's how it's always been and is likely always going to be. And robots are not going to take over the education of our kids, I think. So I don't think we're going to see that kind of radical customization, but I think we're going to see significantly more customization than we have now, and largely by breaking the stranglehold of our local monopolies with a guaranteed stream of government funding. I think once we break that, we're going to have a lot of empowerment to families, but what they choose is not going to look dramatically different from what we have, I think.
I thought you were going to quote from Chairman Mao and talk about a thousand flowers blooming. it's time. Your grandmother would be ashamed that you didn't really read or you didn't fully understand Chairman Mao's Little Red Book.
Yes, I will have to reread.
Thank you so much for talking, Jay. This has been great. We have been talking with J.P. Green. He is an education policy professor at the University of Arkansas and one of the most outspoken and interesting analysts of school reform and school education policy. Again, Jay, at the University of Arkansas, thanks so much for talking.
Thank you.
This has been The Reason Podcast. I'm Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Thanks for listening.